It's so good to see you, my Boca kids, and Merge, and for those watching online still at home, it is so good to be with you today. So kids, all month we have been learning about faith, and we've seen that through our stories and through our memory verse. Remember, faith is trusting in what you can't see, what you cannot see. And we're going to start in Hebrews 11:1. Which is our verse for the month. Faith is being sure of what we hope for. It is being sure of what we do not see. It's such a good reminder for all of us in this room and for our kids and Merge kids, Boca kids and Merge. So today, our story starts off in the early church. Peter, he's been traveling from town to town, telling everyone about Jesus, helping the sick, healing them, helping the poor, starting Bible studies, everything. Because remember, Jesus had Peter as one of his closest friends and gave him that charge to go and start the church. And that's what Peter was doing. So Peter is in Joppa, and he's just kind of chilling out there, hanging out with his friends. And about 40 miles north of Joppa was a town called Caesarea. And there lived a man named Cornelius. Now, unlike Peter, Cornelius was not Jewish. Cornelius was a Gentile. However, he worshiped God and he gave to everyone in need. So one day Cornelius was praying and an angel came in a vision to Cornelius. And this is what the angel said in Acts chapter 10. Let's read it. Now, send men to Joppa. Have them bring back a man named Simon. He is also called Peter. He is staying with another Simon, a man who works with leather. He lives by the sea. So immediately, Cornelius obeys the angel and the vision from God, and he sends three men to go to Joppa to get Peter to bring him back to Caesarea. So the next day, Peter is also praying on his roof, which would have been like a patio. Their roofs were flat back then, just so you know. And so he was praying up there, and it was around lunchtime. He was getting a little hungry. And in his prayer, this is what he saw from God in his vision. Acts 10, verse 11. He saw heaven open up. There he saw something that looked like a large sheet. It was being let down to earth by its four corners. It had all kinds of animals on it, four-footed animals in it. It also had reptiles and birds. Then a voice told him, "Get up, Peter, kill, eat." "No, Lord, I will not," Peter replied. "I've never eaten anything that is not pure and clean." The voice spoke a second time. "Do not say anything that is not pure that God has made clean." This happened three times. Right away, the sheet was taken back up to heaven. Peter was a little confused. And just to give you a little background, kids, and maybe parents, Jews were not allowed to eat certain foods that were considered unclean. So Peter was like, what's this vision about? What is happening here? He is going to see what the vision is truly about and what God is trying to communicate and teach Peter as we see the story unfold. So just then, the men arrive from Caesarea, and they talk with Peter, and they tell him all about Cornelius. And the Holy Spirit tells Peter, go with these men. So the next day, Peter, the soldiers, the servants, and a few other believers, they go to Caesarea, where Cornelius is. And they arrive, and Cornelius begins to tell Peter all about his vision. And immediately, Peter tells Cornelius about Jesus. You see, Cornelius believed in God, but he didn't know about Jesus. So he tells them how Jesus did miracles, and how he lived, and how he died, and how he rose from the dead, and how Peter was able to see him after the resurrection, which is so amazing. And while Peter was talking, while Peter was sharing with Cornelius, his family, his friends, and everyone there, the Holy Spirit came upon them. And right away, Peter was able to baptize them, and they were welcomed into God's family. You see, what the vision was really about and what God was trying to teach Peter was because of what Jesus did on the cross, God's love was not just for the Jewish people. God's love was not just for Peter and his friends. It was for everyone. Because of what God did on the cross, Jews and Gentiles could come to know him. And, well, it took courage to do what Peter did because he had to enter a home of somebody who was different, somebody who didn't grow up like him, somebody who wasn't Jewish. And it took courage. But because he did that, he got to introduce Cornelius and his entire family and everyone who was there to Jesus. You see, kids, today, our bottom line is knowing Jesus changes the way you see others. I'm going to say that one more time because it's so important. Knowing Jesus changes the way you see others. All of us in this room, if we have accepted Jesus, we accepted Jesus because we were told by somebody. You were told by somebody or shown the love of Christ. I was shown the love of Christ at 5 when I accepted Christ by somebody. And we get to do that. So because we know Jesus, we should want to tell others about him. We should want to show the love of Jesus to others in our lives, our friends, our neighbors, our aunts, our uncles, everyone around us, even if they're a little different, even if maybe they're not your best friend, you can still show them the love of Jesus. So my challenge, not just for the kids, but for everyone in this room, is tell somebody about the love of Jesus today, because that's what Peter did with Cornelius. Peter showed us how to tell the love of Jesus to somebody, and we can do that today. Because, kids, Jesus, he changes everything. And without Jesus, well, we have nothing. So I hope that you learned something today from this story, kids. Have a great week.
Good morning. We are glad you're here, and good morning to our online church as well. We're glad you're with us wherever you may be, and many of you I know are outside the city, into the state and other states and around the world. We're glad you're here with us, and you all, we are so glad you're here today. Thank you for being here. How exciting it is to hear worship in person and hear that story that Jackie gave in person and to be together, distancing, but still being able to say hello to friends and others. So thank you for being here. I'm down here for a few moments because I want to make a few personal comments before I start my sermon, which I will move up to the top in just a minute. Last week, I gave a sermon that I called A Personal Response to Race. And I think I had probably more emails and texts than any other sermon I've ever given. Just so you know, it was about 10 to 1 positive. But there were a lot of questions, a lot of different interactions. I had a great time talking and texting and emailing people, so thank you for your responses. But I do want to clarify one thing, and so I'm doing it down here because it's a personal thing. So I will clarify that, and then I'm going to go up and start a new subject today, and I'll say what that is. But last week I made the statement that I believe that when you say all lives matter, that that is unchristian. Remember I said that? If you weren't here, you're going, what did he say? Well, most of you were here, you heard it online, and those of you heard it, I said, again, I'll repeat it, if you say all lives matter, it's unchristian. That's what I said. What I probably should have said was when you say all lives matter, it is unchristianly. I should have turned it into more, it's not acting the right way. And let me just explain this just for a moment. I did say also that I believe black lives really do matter. What we need to know that I was not speaking about political agendas. I didn't speak about the president, Mr. Biden, Democrats, Republicans, red, blue, hashtag Black Lives Matter, police organizations. It was nothing about any of that, though I was accused of a lot of that, which is okay. I have big enough shoulders to take those accusations. I was speaking about individual people and how we respond to individual people. And I think that is very important. So let me say why I still believe that when you say all lives matter in this context today, this month, this summer, that all lives matter is really an unchristian response. Let me explain, and I'll do it with a negative response and I'll do it with a positive. Let me speak negatively. Because it is a true statement. All lives matter is a true statement. So I'm not saying the truth or falsity of the statement. I'm talking about the appropriateness of the statement. Let me give a statement that's also very true. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Is that a true statement? It's in the Bible. I believe it. It's a core tenet of our faith. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We all agree to that. That's a part of who we are. Now, as a pastor, I have had to confront people with sin many times. I've had to confront business people with bad ethics. I've had to confront husbands who have abandoned their families, children who have abandoned all kinds of sin. And when I go to them, sometimes I'll go to them and I'll go, "We got to deal with your sin." And they'll go, "Well, aren't you a sinner? Isn't everybody a sinner?" Yes, but that is not the point right now. The point right now, my friend, is not that we are all sinners. And yes, we are all sinners. That is a true statement, but that is not important right now. What's important is your sin. We've got to deal with it. You see the difference? There's a huge difference between all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And now, brother or sister, you got a problem here with your sin and we got to deal with it. You see, the point of the spear is very specific. That's a negative one. Let me give you a positive one. So, positive one is here at church, we have opened a new ministry just 2 weeks ago called City House. City House is an opportunity for single women with children who are homeless to have a home. And we're housing them here on our property. Many of you don't know, we have a couple of apartments in a little building behind the big building across the street, and we have that, we've cleaned it up, and we got more work to do. Two families have moved in the last 2 weeks. It's unbelievable. Three more families, God willing, are going to move in the next couple of weeks through August. And then hopefully we'll be able to renovate the rest of the building and we'll have another four or five families move in. We may have 8 or 10 single women and their children who are homeless in a home. You don't know this, maybe, because homeless people in Palm Beach County are hidden, but there are thousands, not hundreds, thousands of homeless people in Palm Beach County. And there's an acute problem with women and their children. Now, when I say this church has a real desire to help single women who have children who are homeless to have a home and to be spiritually renewed and to learn about job training and all the things both from a physical side and a spiritual side, I am not saying that men who are homeless are not important, am I? Or Vietnam veterans who are homeless are not important. Or women without children are not important. I'm not saying that that is true. What I'm saying, all homeless are important. But we have chosen to take care of an acute problem here in South Palm Beach County of single women with their children who need a home and need to restart. Do you see the difference? So I can stand up here and go, the homeless, we've got to deal with the homeless. But at some point in time, I've got to deal with the acute issue of single women who have children, who are living under a bridge, living behind a tree, living in a park near you that you don't even know, or maybe if they're lucky, have a car to live in. Do you see what I'm saying here? It is true that all homeless need to be helped, and I wish I could help all 2 or 3,000 homeless in Palm Beach County. We can't, but we can help these. Do you see that? Well, right now in our country and in our culture, all lives do matter, but that's at 10,000 feet. All lives matter, and you know what? The elderly matter, and we need to deal with the elderly, and the unborn matter, and we need to deal with the unborn, and others matter, and we need to deal with them. But right now, in our country, there is an issue. Black versus white, black versus police, all these kind of things. And we as Christians, if we want to stay at the 10,000 foot level in the clouds and argue about all lives matter, this is not the place to be. We need to have boots on the ground, and we need to do something about it. We as Christians are not called just to be theological robots and go, yes, yes, no, yeah. No, we are here to do something. And I believe if we want to act Christianly, we have to deal with the issues at hand that are in front of us. Of course, all lives matter. And you know what? Next year, we may need to be dealing with the elderly, or we need to be dealing with the unborn, which I have been in that battle since 1972 when I was this tall. I've been in that battle. We've all been in that battle, and the unborn still matter. But right now, we have an issue that we as Christians need to bring together these groups, because I believe we have the answer. And the answer is not theology. The answer is the love of Jesus Christ. And you and I need to do that. We need to take the love of Jesus Christ to our brothers and sisters who are hurting, whether you're right, whether they're black, white, blue, whatever it is, absolutely. But we have an acute issue in this country right now, and we cannot ignore that acute issue. And I believe we as this church, if I thought about it this week, if I was a teacher, I would grade us. I'm the leader, so I'm taking the blame. I would put us somewhere around a D, D, not a B, but a D in this area. And I want us to get up to the B or A level on this one. I want us as a church to be in the reconciling business and the love of Jesus business and the love of our neighbors as ourselves business. And yeah, we can talk theology. I'll talk all day theology. I love talking theology, but I want to get down where the rubber meets the road, because that's where people are hurting. And we as a church need to deal with that. That's what I was trying to say last week. I wasn't making a political statement, but if you think that's political, then so be it. Because we as Christians need to make a difference. There are 300,000 churches in this country. Count them, 300,000 churches. Not all as big as ours. Some are 50, some are 100, some are 200. But if us 300,000, with all the people in there, decided to do something about this problem would go away. But we're either ignoring it or we're a part of the problem. And I want us to become a part of the solution. And so we are going to work through some of these things. And that's why it was interesting. Last week I gave half my sermon was the problem, half was the solution. Not the solution like the big, but some personal renewal. You got to deal with this personally before we can deal with this corporately. And you remember I said four things. One is we have blind spots, and we need to deal with them. We've learned to put labels on people so we don't have to treat them as our neighbor. Remember that? We got to stop labeling people, because when we label people, they no longer have to be my neighbor. And I can just put them over in this category. We got to take those labels off so that the entire nation is our neighbor. Not that you can help everyone in the nation, no, but everyone, we have that opportunity. Third, I talked about in-groups and out-groups. And if you weren't here, too long to explain. But basically, we love our in-group and we ignore our out-group. Let's give our out-group in-group love. The way you love the people you love, could you love others that same way? And when we begin loving others that same way, I think we'll begin doing, because we know how to love people. We know how to have community with people. So let's do it with those who are not in our personal in-group. In other words, kind of break the walls down of your in-group and then open it up a little more and show that love that you have, because I really do think we love each other, that we just kind of open it up. Then the fourth thing I said was justice, mercy, and humility. Remember Micah 6:8? So those were my four application points. All of them are very understandable, but very hard to do, right? They're very hard to do. One of them is not so easy to understand, and that's where I want to take us today. What is justice? We know what humility is because we know what pride is. We know what mercy is because we know what anger is. We know what color blindness is or blindness or anything like this. We know what that is. Blind spots. We know how to love and hate. We know what that means and if we're doing it or not. But do we really know what justice is? And what does the Bible have to say about justice? This is going to take 2 weeks because, can I tell you, the Bible is chocked full of justice and how to deal justly. So when you go, when the Bible in Micah 6:8, which as you know is on my ring, this is my life verse, justice, mercy, and humility. So I am trying to practice this and I still give myself a D on it. I'm working to get better. We need to realize the Bible is wide open on the subject of justice. And so we're going to take 2 weeks or we'd have to be here for a long time today. So we're going to take 2 points today and a couple points next week and bring conclusion in it. I want you to know I'm not the only one who's working on this, and I'm certainly not the smartest guy on the block on this. I'll give you a couple of people that I have resourced over the last couple of weeks. One is a guy named Brian Stevenson. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's an attorney out of Jackson, Mississippi, a fine Christian man, and has really worked in this whole area of justice. Another is Tony Evans, who many of you know and has really worked hard in this area. And another one is Tim Keller, who just retired as the pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian up in New York City. The first two are African American, the second is Anglo. The first one's an attorney, the second two are pastors, and they are really doing a lot of work in this area, and so I've been listening to them. I'm not personal friends with them, although I've met two of them, but I am working through some of those things. So this is not something I've just come up with. Other Christians around the country are working through this, and we're trying to, like the COVID, we're trying to figure this out when it comes to really understanding. And here's the thing, let's be careful, and then I'm going to get up there and do the sermon. Words get real charged real easy. And we can get stuck in the words. I want to get stuck in what we do about it. You know, some would say there's systemic racism. Some would say there's the breakdown of the family. Some would say the government has failed. Some would say the church has failed. Okay, we can point fingers all day long. But what are we going to do starting in the summer of 2020? Ongoing. And I think that's what's important. And we can argue, is it this or is it that? And is it this? It might be all of it. It might be some of it. But where are we heading? Can we do that today? Turn to Isaiah chapter 58. And I'm moving upstairs. Isaiah 58, verses 1 to 7. And you see up there, here is my basic premise. God puts absolute importance on justice. Justice is not just a little subcategory in the Bible. Let's talk about justice today, just some little thing. It is so full, and I'm going to be running through the Bible today. So you have a couple of choices. One is you can write down the verses. Every verse I say I'll have up there in just a moment, or you can get to them if you can, or if you have your app, or if you have a pen, you figure out how you want to do it, or you may just say, I'm going to listen to it, maybe go back to it online later and write it all down. I don't want you to get caught up with just writing, and missing what I'm saying, but God puts absolute importance on justice. Isaiah, the great prophet, 700 years before Christ, chapter 58, verse 1. Cry aloud. Do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Declare to my people their transgression, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek daily me and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the judgment of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. This is a picture of people who are worshiping daily and part of the ministry of the synagogue, or wasn't the synagogues back then, it was the temple, and are really doing. And then he goes, they even, verse 3, fast. Fast is when you take away something, usually food, and put in its place, instead of eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you put in its place a spiritual event. Prayer, other things. And so you fast so you can do a spiritual event. Why have you fasted and you see it not? Why have you humbled yourselves and take no knowledge of it? Hadn't told us what they're missing. Behold, in the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasure and you oppress your workers. Behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with a wicked fist. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice be heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose? This is God speaking. Is this the fast that I choose, a day for a person to humble himself? Is it to bow down his head like a reed and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast and a day acceptable to the Lord? In other words, let's look what's happened here, starting in verse 2. Yet you seek me daily. Seek me. These are people who are worshiping. These are people who are sitting where you're sitting, have their hands up and are worshiping, and they're doing it daily. You and I do it once a week or twice a week. They're daily worshiping the Lord. These are the good people. And they delight to know my ways. These are the people, that's the ethics, the morality side, doing what's right, doing the laws. These are good people. These aren't the bad people. These aren't the Amorites and the Amalekites and the Canaanites and the Philistines that we've all been, and then at this point in time, the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Persians. No, these are the good people. And then they are fasting, which is like the height of spiritual success. When you have the ability to fast, I know people that fast for a day, for 3 days, some fast for 40 days. I mean, this is like, you guys are the A-plussers who can fast for 40 days. And he goes, wait, why are you fasting? Is it so you can show me you're humble, God says? That's not why you fast. Verse 6. Is not this fast that I choose to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? What he's saying is the purpose of a fast is that you get free from your sin so you can help the poor and oppressed. That's kind of interesting. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry? See, in other words, do you not eat? You're fasting. Is it to just to prove that you can miss a meal? Or do you take that money, back then they didn't have the money, they had the bread, and you give that bread to the poor? That's, if you're not going to eat today, give it away to the poor. That's an interesting concept, which they knew nothing about. And bring the homeless poor into your house. When you see the naked, to cover them and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. So here, point number one, and just kind of overarching, there is a direct correlation between helping the poor and your own spiritual vitality. Can I just repeat that? There's a direct correlation between helping the poor and the oppressed and the needy and your own spiritual vitality. It's not you're over here working your spiritual vitality and then over here are some issues and every once in a while you maybe throw a little money, you throw a little influence, you throw a day of work there once a year and help them. He goes, no, this is directly connected. Your spiritual vitality and justice to the poor are one and the same. So what it means is if you don't have justice, you are not spiritual. Hate to say that, but don't get mad at me. Write your email to God this week. These emails go to God, not to me. And the way you do that is to pray. I'm just reading the Bible here. Now, let's move on. 2 points, and I've got some sub-points, and then next week I'll give a couple of more. Well, before I do, God puts ultimate and absolute importance on justice. Now, let me give you a couple of verses. Isaiah chapter 1, you go, well, Bill, you just pulled one chapter out of the Bible. Isaiah 1, verse 15 through 17. When you spread your hands out, in other words, when you are worshiping God and you are spreading your hands out, I will hide my eyes from you. Is that amazing? God says, you are pretending to worship me, I'm hiding my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, plead the widow's cause. There is a direct connection between your spiritual vitality and how you treat the poor, the widow, the fatherless. Justice is connected to your spiritual life, and injustice is connected to a pretending spiritual life. And you go, well, that's the Old Testament. Let's go to the New Testament. James chapter 2. We talked about this last year in our study of James. James chapter 2, verse 14 to 17. And if you can't run there real quick, don't worry about it. Just write it down. You can look at it later. James says, what good is it, my brothers and sister, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, without giving them the things needed for their body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. There is a direct correlation between what you say and believe and what you do. What you say and believe and what you do, and it is directly correlated. And if there is a disconnect here between justice and faith, he is saying it's the faith part that's the problem, not this part that's the problem. Amazing. Let's go over just quickly 1 John chapter 3. 1 John, not the Gospel of John, but the Epistle of John, chapter 3, verse 17 and 18. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him. Isn't that interesting? He doesn't say close his pocketbook, close his money bag back then, close his barns back then for the wealthy who had food. He says closes his heart. John makes this a spiritual matter. It is your heart that is closed. How does God's love abide in that person who has a closed heart to the needy? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in the truth. The beautiful thing about the Bible is it's got all these incredible great things that are up here, but it takes you right to the ground to where you live. We need to do something where we live. We cannot just talk about it and occasionally throw a penny this way or a penny that way. Bottom line on this first one, bottom line. Doing justice is not for a few do-gooders. See, right now at our church, we have about 100 of you who are out doing good things. You're out at Boca Helping Hands. You're in the prisons. You're clothing. You're working at the homeless shelter. There's about 100 of us. It may even be 150. So that means we're about a church of 1,000 or 1,200. That means 10, 12% of us are doing the good. And that's good. You're doing the good. It's good that you do good. But the rest of us just go on our way, and we go, boy, isn't it great that our church does good things over there and does good things over there? Please understand, we are all responsible. It is not a corporate responsibility, and then we can say, boy, our church does it. These are individual responsibilities. What am I doing? Am I doing this, or am I not doing this? Are you doing this, or are you not doing this? It's good that you're with a church that is doing this, but I wish we had a church that was doing 70%, 80%, 90% of us were doing things of justice and helping the poor and the oppressed and the needy and the fatherless and the et cetera. This is why we support 4Kids. This is why we support Boca Helping Hands. This is why we support these things, and usually we'll get a dozen people helping and a dozen people helping. And a dozen people helping, and a dozen people helping. And we're a church of 1,000 or 1,200. I'd love us to open up something, go, wow, 300 want to do it. 400 want to help. And here's the thing, you don't have to wait for us. You just go do it yourself. That's the beautiful thing. And that's what you need to look at, your own personal responsibility. So now let's look at the biblical aspects of justice. And these, I have 4 points on this. I'm only going to do 2 today. Number 1, equal treatment for all. God's view of justice is equal treatment for all. Leviticus 24, verse 22 says this. At the beginning, way back with the children of Israel and them coming out of Egypt and heading towards the promised land, they weren't there. He says, you shall have the same rule for the sojourner, that's the immigrant, and for the native, for I am the Lord your God. In other words, he's saying there is no difference. Equal treatment for all. Your status with your government is not the same as your status with God. And we as Christians need to have treatment for all with equality. Equal treatment for all. Now there's a point to this, and this is an interesting one because people bring this up, those who like to discuss it rather than do anything, and this is true. We are all one blood. Now, a lot of people are saying this whole race thing is, how can there be racism when we're all one race? We're all one race. And in Acts 17, it says that. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling. And he, God, made one man from one man every nation of all of humankind. We all came from one person, is what that scripture says. Who is that person? Adam. We all came from Adam and Eve. Okay, God created Adam and Eve, and we're all descendants from there. So you could say we're one race, and that misses the point. If you don't like to use the word race, which is used to do, you can use ethnicity, you can use various words to describe different groups of people. But over the years, over the thousands of years, for whatever reason, people have loved to move people into categories. And in this country, we have major categories. And we have African Americans, we have Anglo whites, we have Hispanics, or Latins, I should say, a better word. And we have others as well, Native Americans, et cetera, et cetera. And there's subcategories to all of these, but we are one. But what's interesting is you go, yeah, that's true, but we're really not one anymore. That was then. And remember, go back to Isaiah 58 if you still have your Bible near there. The last sentence of verse 7, I didn't speak to it. It says, I'll read the whole verse. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Isaiah, this is God speaking with Isaiah, is this. Do you realize you and the poor are the same flesh? When you help the poor, you have helped your flesh. They are the same. You are the same. When you help someone else, it's like helping your own family. See, we have segregated ourselves in these huge categories. And God says, no, your heart needs to be. Now, you can't help every single person. That's impossible. But as God had lead you and you're helping people, you're helping your brothers and your sisters. You see, there's no labels here. I can't label you off. Like, you're over here. I don't need to help you. I'm helping these people. And I've labeled you off. And I said last week, we got to stop labeling people off and realizing, because in South Florida, I don't know where you're listening, wherever you may be, but in South Florida, the world is moving to us. You got to realize the world is your next door neighbor. You don't know who or where that person is from and their background. God is bringing them to us. So if we begin to label people, we can't do that anymore, right? I mean, we're labeling people. We just got to stop that. Next, let's keep going here. Sorry, I got a lot of notes here and a lot of thoughts here. Number 2. So the number 1 is we all need equal treatment. Number 2, though, in the Bible, there's special concern for those without power. In the Bible, there's special concern for those without power. Let me give you a couple of examples. Proverbs 31, 8 and 9. This is where God says, speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. You see, there is special concern for the needy. There's a special concern for the poor. And God says, we as believers, as followers, need to do something about it. And it's not that we go, oh, Brian Stevenson, you do that. Or, oh, this little group over here that's working with our poor people, you do something. No, we all need to do it. Now, that isn't so bad. Now, let me really get bad here. If you insult the poor, you have insulted God. Is that in the Bible? Zechariah 7, verse 9 and 10. Thus says the Lord of hosts, render true judgments, show kindness and mercy to one another. Do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the sojourner, or the poor, and let none of you devise evil against another in your heart. And Proverbs 14:31, which is up there, also says, whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker. Who is his maker? The creator, God. You insult a poor person, you have insulted God, his maker, because all of us are made in the image of God. Are we not? Boy, that's a theological concept that's way up here, the imago Deo, the image of God. Bring it down to earth, and that means you and I are the same. And when I insult you, I have insulted the creator of you. And I can't do that. And insults are not just verbal insults. You can insult people by ignoring them. There's a lot of ways to insult. We have these great ways of insulting people in this country that are just ungodly. Next, but the positive, if we give to the poor, we give to God. We give to the poor, we give to God. Proverbs 19, verse 17. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay from this deed. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord. My friends, if I take you out to lunch, when we're allowed to do this, you're going to take me out to lunch. If you go, hey, Bill, can I borrow $100? Oh, yeah, here's $100. You're going to give it back to me. You're just in a little need. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is when you do something for someone who can never do it back for you. That's the generosity we're talking about. See, we want a one-to-one. I give to you, I want back. That's what Americans love, right? Give, get. Give, get. And hopefully I get a little interest on it or a little more. I give one, maybe I get back one and a half. No, God says, be generous. Be generous. Because when you're generous with the poor, you have shown generosity to me, God says. Now, we as Christians, so let me speak to you as you're Christians. I'm speaking to everybody here, but if you're a Christian, here's why. And let me give you my last point. God identifies with the poor. Just write that down. God identifies with the poor. If you forget everything else I said since I'm standing here, he identifies with the poor. Think of the story in 2 Kings 5. There's a story about Naaman. Naaman was this wealthy man who lived in the north, not in Israel, but I think it was Babylon at the time. I could be wrong. And he had leprosy, and nobody could help him. And somebody said, there's a God in Israel who can help you. Go down. So Naaman went to the king of Babylon, and I think it's Babylon, excuse me if it's not, went to the king and said, I need letters of introduction. I'm going to take money. So Naaman goes down with this entourage to the king of Israel. And he brings letters from the other king. He brings money. He goes to the king of Israel and goes, here you go, bro. Where's my miracle? I want my miracle because you serve a God who does miracles. And the king goes, and I'm paraphrasing here, that's not our God. Our God is not an aristocrat. Our God is not a king like an earthly king. You got to go to Elisha, the prophet. Oh, is he in next door? No, he's out in the wilderness. And he goes to Elisha, and what does Elisha make him do? Go bathe in the dirtiest river in the region. This guy is from where the Euphrates and the Tigris, those powerful, beautiful rivers. He comes to the Jordan River. If you have ever been to the Jordan River down at that part, it is nothing but mud and sand. And you go down there, he goes, what am I doing here? Why couldn't I do it over there? Because everybody else's God goes to the powerful. The Greek gods went to the powerful. The Roman gods went to the powerful. The Persian gods went to the powerful. The Babylonian gods, Mesopotamian gods, Egyptian gods all went to the powerful. Our God went to the poor. And you go, wait, Bill, you're reading into this. Okay. God sent his son. Where did he send his son? I think it says a feeding trough, doesn't it? Oh, we use the word manger. I think that's where Jesus came. And then he was kicked out of his country, and he was a refugee. Not very aristocratic there. And he goes to Egypt. Then he comes back. And then he goes, he didn't even have a home. The sparrows have their nest. The foxes have their holes. But the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. This is God, right? Jesus was homeless, for goodness sakes. And then he gets tried illegally, and he was oppressed illegally, and there was anywhere between 3 and 6 trials, depending on how you reread these things, all illegal. He was mistreated the entire time. And the only thing he had left was his robe. And they bargained that away too, right? The only thing he had, the only thing inheritable was his robe, and they stole it from him. Couldn't even give it to his mother. The only earthly thing he had, he could have given it to his mother, and they stole that away from him as well. God is the God of the poor, and God identifies with the poor. The problem is you and I are middle class and upper middle class, and in America, that means we're really upper class. We identify with the wealthy. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with money. Nothing wrong with money. Nothing wrong with education. Nothing wrong with wealth. A lot of wealthy people in the Bible. Solomon, who wrote those proverbs about the poor and about generosity, was very wealthy. It's what we do with what God gives us. That's important. And God, because here, and we're going to talk about this next week because we're going to end right now. Time's up. Is that God gives to us so we can give to others. God does not give to me so I can hoard it. God does not give to me, oh, wow, you're good, Bill. I'm going to give you a little extra. Maybe he gives to me so I can give that little extra away and give it to other people. And that, I think, is the key, my friends. Now let's close. And we're going to pick this up with point number 3 next week. 18 years ago, I was in a hospital. And my son, Elizabeth and our son, was dying. He had just had an open heart surgery, and he couldn't come off the lung machine, you know, where they pump it, and then when you get out of the surgery, they wean you off the pump, and your heart starts up. It's a miracle how that works. We have people here that know more about this than I. And he got out of the surgery, and his heart wouldn't start up, so he's on the pump. Well, unlike a pump for your lung, a respirator, you can only live so many days on a heart pump. It's called a left ventricle assist device. And back then they were huge. Now they're small. They were huge. And all these tubes are running around his body. He's bleeding to death, and his heart's not working. So when they're pumping his heart, he's bleeding it out. And so they're pumping plasma in him. All this is happening, and he's dying. He's about 30 pounds. He's 5 years old, and he's dying. And Elizabeth would be there in the day, and I'd be there at night. And so we're in this room, one nurse per room, wood floor, little rocking chair they give you. And there were 4 nurses at the nurse's station ready for the change. And I had just come in, and it was like 6 or 7 when they make the 12-hour change, and there were 4 nurses there. And there they were. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I prayed to God. I said, God, give me one of these 3. But not this one. Don't give me this one. because I didn't think she had good enough education. She was from another country, another ethnicity, and I thought, these are three white women from American schools. I want them. So I said, God, give me one of these, not her. What did God do? He gave me her. He gave me her. I said, God, what are you doing? I gave you three, 70, you had three chances on me. And I sat in the rocking chair, and she walked into the room, the ward, it was kind of all glass. She goes, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. No other nurse ever said that to me. He's going to make it. The doctor didn't even say that to me. He's going to make it. And I watched her pump that plasma in him, and that plasma, those empty bags just stacked up, and it's bleeding out into this bucket. It was horrendous. And every time I woke up from this light sleep, she'd go, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. He's going to make it. He's not going to die on my watch. He's going to make it. And he made it. He made it. And that morning, she left. I thanked her. I got on my knees, and I begged God to forgive me. I didn't ask him. I begged him because I had sinned. I don't have a racist bone in my body, so I thought. I am not prejudiced, biased, nothing. And if anybody, they would say, no, not Bill. But in my heart, in my deepest heart, I was. And I had to beg God to forgive me. I don't know what is in your life right now. If it's, you know, as I said last week, being stingy, or not being generous, I'll talk about it next week. Not being generous is not being stingy, it's being unjust. Generosity has more to do with justice than stinginess. What is it in your life that maybe you now need to just pray to God and say, God, I need to clear this out so that you can use me. Our country needs me right now. This country needs every person in this room right now. It might be at your office, might be in your neighborhood, might be with your family, might be a larger influence you have, your education. Those of you who are teachers are going back to teach kids who have been off school for the last 4 months hearing a lot of things, and you need to bring justice into their lives when you go back to school next month. Some of you are in college. You're going to head back to school. You've been online. You're going back to school. We need to act Christianly at this point in time and do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly before our God. Do you believe that? This is what we need to do as men and women of God. And I know I've gone over, so I apologize. But the God who sent his son, Jesus, became poor so that you and I could become rich. Not rich in money, but rich in relationship to the Father. This is what Christianity, I don't even like that word. This is what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ, to realize that God became poor so I could become rich. And again, not rich. This is not prosperity gospel stuff I'm talking about here. I am talking about rich in the Spirit of God. And if you have never experienced that, today is the day to do that. Today is the day to come to Jesus Christ. And in so coming to him, you don't come to him and say, here's my wallet, here's my education, here's my great family, I'm an American. Who cares? We come on our knees. And if you can't get on your knees, do it metaphorically. We come humbly, say, God, thank you for all you did for us. And can I say this? He will forgive you. He forgives you. He forgave what I did that day with that woman. She didn't even know it, but he forgave me because God is in the reconciling business. Go to him today and pray. And if you don't know Jesus, we can't come down here. I'm so sorry. but you can go to the back. There will be four or five people in the back. There's a big sign that says prayer. Go back there. If you have to walk out the side doors because you got to go this way or whatever, just go to that end, to the kind of the east side of the building, and there'll be people there for prayer, for reconciliation, to know Jesus for the first time. Will you do it? Let's pray together.